This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. Today we're talking about the pandemic's effect on rural hospitals in Indiana. And if you have questions or comments on our show today, let us know on Facebook or Twitter at All In Indiana. You can also leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. We just need your name, where you're calling from, and a quick question or comment. We will do our best to get it in front of the panel today. Again, that's 866-476-3881, or leave us a high-quality audio message with our new All In Vox Pop app. Get it wherever you get apps, All In Vox Pop. We're joined now by Kara Veal, CEO of the Indiana Rural Health Association. Kara, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
We also have with us Phil Ellis, Network Director for the Indiana Statewide Rural Health Network. Phil, welcome to you.
Thank you, Matt. Good to be with you.
Well, let's start out really broad, Kara, before we get into some of the smaller details. How are rural hospitals in Indiana doing right now?
Rural hospitals are recovering. As most are aware, back in March, April, May, we were forced to channel our attention to ensuring enough care was available to be able to provided to patients with COVID-19. And so many of our rural hospitals in Indiana were required to suspend elective procedures, which did take a toll on the financials of many of our rural hospitals. But thankfully, we have implemented safety measures and preparedness plans that allow us to return to quote unquote normal operations at the same time while still allowing us to care for those COVID-19 patients. So we're recovering, still some opportunity to improve financially, but we're on mend.
So Phil, what's the most common challenge that rural hospitals are facing, would you say?
They face a variety of challenges, Matt. I think right now what they are struggling with the most is looking at the long-term financial picture. The state and federal government both were very responsive in producing aids for funding, but a large portion of that will have to be paid back. They're still working out details on that. So when we look at the financial picture of a hospital in rural Indiana, they are financially sound now, but they do face repayment programs, and they'll have to be able to ensure the financial stability of their hospitals to be able to serve the people in their communities.
And Kara, I mean, when we talk about treating COVID, I mean, does that come at an expense, or is it a very thin margin, and so it's cutting into what would normally be income time for rural hospitals? What's going on? I guess, what's at work?
Sure. Yeah, it can be a combination of the two. You know, we see that a lot of our rural hospital partners are trying to identify the best way to provide services specific to the coronavirus without having to interrupt normal operations as well. Mm. And that can come at a cost. So we've seen a lot of hospitals implement some infrastructure changes, so physical changes to the actual facility. And many of our hospital partners are creating or adding additions to their facility, such as negative airflow rooms, specific locations for COVID-19 testing, additional facility requirements for ventilator management. And so there's a significant cost to that, to be able to continue to provide care to coronavirus patients. At the same time, there are specific, requirements, obviously, to continue to care for patients who are not affected by coronavirus and still be able to provide them with the care that they need on an ongoing basis. So it's kind of a combination of the two. We do see increased costs, obviously, associated with specific care and treatment for coronavirus patients at the same time and providing care to others as well.
And Kara, are there some other issues that rural hospitals are dealing with, especially problems that hospitals in urban areas might not have?
Absolutely. Yeah. Rural hospitals tend to see patients that have higher comorbidities and illnesses just in general, at a higher rate than urban urban hospitals. So pre-pandemic, we were seeing issues associated with that, you know, higher Medicare population. So our patients in rural communities tend to be older. And so we see, obviously, you know, typical aging and illnesses associated with aging already in place in our rural hospitals at a higher margin than we do at urban areas anyway. There are a lot of financial issues that rural hospitals tend to see than compared to our urban counterparts. And so, you know, there's significant cost to infrastructure. The buildings tend to be older. There are higher recruitment and retention costs for clinicians and providers within the rural area. So, yeah, there are both, you know, financial constraints and social determinants of health at a different rate than what we would typically see maybe in the urban setting.
Phil, is it easy to have a good grasp on everything that's happening? Are there and is there enough communication, data collection coming from all these hospitals?
We're very fortunate that through a network of multiple relationships with industry professionals, both legal and accounting, as well as the expertise within our own staff, that we've been able to get the information that our hospitals need. We're connected with the National Rural Health Association, and they likewise provide updated information, especially information coming out of Washington on the programs that have been put out to support rural health. So yes, collectively, Matt, we do get excellent information that we continually push out to our members to keep them informed and updated on what's happening.
And Kara, let's ask another big question. What role do hospitals play in rural communities? I mean, is it different from the role that other hospitals play in some ways?
Yeah, in rural communities, hospitals tend to be the biggest or one of the largest employers within the community. And so when there is something such as a pandemic or a financial disturbance to the hospital, that can have a trickle down effect on the community as a whole. And so, you know, we see that in rural communities as well, if there is such as, you know, with the pandemic, with the COVID-19 pandemic, if there's an outbreak in the community, it can be detrimental to many, many businesses, many households and the community as a whole. And so, yeah, there are a lot of, I guess, negative opportunities that the pandemic can impact on a grand scale in a rural community.
And Phil, let's take the pandemic out of the equation. What role does a rural hospital play, I guess, in non-pandemic times that would be different from, say, other hospitals, maybe elsewhere?
Rural hospitals tend to be a focal point of the community as they try to push out care to patients in advance of severe illness. They put on health fairs. They bring education. There are a lot of challenges in rural health. As Kara mentioned, the comorbidities are much higher. So the rural hospital has to be the beacon of information in that local community to share programs for tobacco use, for obesity, for so many things. They work closely with schools to bring information to children and try to reach them through that vehicle. They also provide a lot of food. Hospitals are a large source of food service in local communities. And so they do play a modified role to what an urban or a suburban hospital does. They are seen as the center of everything impacting healthcare.
Kara, what kind of support or assistance have rural hospitals gotten since the pandemic started?
Yeah, there's several programs that one program that was in place actually prior to the pandemic was called the Medicare Accelerated Advance Payment Program, or MAP, as we refer to it. And it's actually a program that was in place and it was designed for a situation such as a pandemic like the COVID-19. And this program is really it's really a loan that allows hospitals to be able to collect dollars when claims are not being submitted pretty much at the rate that they typically are submitted. So it allows dollars to continue to come into hospitals. And so the MAP program was in place, and thankfully it has since been modified from its original version in response to the fact that the COVID-19 pandemic remains ongoing. So the MAP program was originally designed to basically be a loan that after 120 days, hospitals would then start paying those dollars back. Well, as we know, the pandemic has lasted longer than 120 days. And so thankfully, the federal government heard the concerns of many hospitals, including our rural partners, and have agreed to modify those terms. So repayment terms have been modified to allow up to a year or two before payment has to start to be returned. And the insurance rates have been modified as well. They were pretty significant. And it's better for especially our rural hospitals that are already taxed financially. There's also dollars through the CARES Act, through the Provider Relief Fund, that allow dollars to come in to help support our rural hospitals additionally financially. There are rural health payments that come through, so specifically for areas that are designated as rural health clinics. There are additional dollars that have been allotted for those who meet those qualifications and apply for that funding. So several avenues of funding that have been in place and implemented to support our rural hospitals.
Phil, in about 30 seconds, what's the most important support rural hospitals could get right now that they're not getting? What would make the biggest difference?
Continued support from their communities is essential, and we've seen an outpouring of that. I have never seen so much favorable relations with our communities. I have to go back to early April when we were delivering PPE to our hospitals and pulling in their parking lots at 3 o'clock in the morning in sub-freezing temperatures, seeing providers working out of triage tents was remarkable. That was a very surreal feeling. So the continued support of the member communities is essential and very much appreciated.
Phil Ellis is Network Director for the Indiana Statewide Rural Health Network. Phil, thank you for your time today.
Thank you, Matt.
And Kara Veal is CEO of the Indiana Rural Health Association. Kara, thanks for your work.
Thank you. Appreciate it, Matt.
We'll be live with new guests after a quick break. We're talking about how rural hospitals are doing right now. You can send us a high-quality audio message with our new all-in Vox Pop app. It's free and easy to use, or you can leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. I'm Matt Pelzer. We're back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelzer. We're talking today about how the COVID-19 pandemic is affecting rural hospitals in Indiana and the role they play in communities across the state. We would love your questions and comments on the topic. We're on Facebook and Twitter at All In Indiana, or leave us a voicemail with your first name and where you're calling from to 866-476-3881. 866-476-3881, or leave us a high quality audio message with our new All In Vox Pop app. Just search All In Vox Pop wherever you get apps for your phone. We're joined now by two guests. Stephanie Laws is Vice President and Administrator at Union Hospital Clinton. Stephanie, welcome. And welcome. Brian Tabor is President of the Indiana Hospital Association. Brian, welcome to you.
Thanks for having me.
Stephanie, can you tell us a little bit about Union Hospital Clinton?
Yes, Union Hospital Clinton is what's called a critical access hospital, which is a designation that we have from the federal government that we are a necessary provider rural hospital in our community. We service one of the longest geographical counties in the state, Vermilion, and we also service Park County, which is our county to the north and the east, which has no hospital in it. And then Fountain County is to our north, and there is no hospital there. So for a very contiguous area around us, we are the only hospital provider before you get to Terre Haute. So we have a high proportion of population that are low income. Last I checked, Vermilion County had the highest unemployment rate in the state. We have a lot of elderly and severely ill patients that suffer from a lot of chronic medical conditions. So we have a fairly vulnerable community, both economically and medically.
What's the biggest issue you're facing right now then that's connected in some way to the pandemic?
One of the biggest issues that we see, and just to touch upon in the last segment, was that early on in the pandemic, we did, per the executive order, cut out electives, meaning patients needed to come in for maybe that colonoscopy, for cancer screening, or other types of procedures that could be safely put off, as well as diagnostics, mammograms, and such. And so throughout that period, obviously, that was a financial impact for us. And even though that was a great financial burden, we still did not furlough employees. We did not incur any pay cuts. We did not suspend any benefits. We continued to match retirement for Union Health. And we also allowed employees to borrow additional PTO time or paid time off time if they were short, because we did see big declines in our census then. And since that point, with the lifting of that executive order, we have begun our recovery phase. And now we are seeing an increase in our volume, both inpatient and through the emergency room. And it's a mix of patients that both have COVID needs, as well as those who don't have COVID needs. And one of the biggest issues that we see among the population that we're serving today is these elderly patients in our community, those who have multiple medical issues. What we hypothesize here is that they have put off their care during this slowdown phase where we pulled patients back and said we need to isolate, we need to socially distance. And we think that patients have made choices to forego primary medical care or specialty care during that time, because the patients coming in right now are really sick. They have a lot of conditions that are chronic and need to be managed. So we're seeing those length of stays be maybe increased more than what they were pre-pandemic, just because people are sicker when they come in.
Brian Tabor, can you give us an idea on how many other hospitals in the state have that designation as a critical access hospital? How common is that?
Yes, there are 35 critical access hospitals in the state of Indiana. There are about 120 what we call acute care hospitals, and that's a hospital with an emergency room. The hospital I think your listeners would tend to think of, the Blue H out front, there are specialty hospitals and others. But your general community hospitals are about 120 facilities across the state. And so 35 of them have this designation that Stephanie talked about. And then probably another 25 or more are a bit larger, but still very much in a rural community. So it's almost about half of the hospitals in Indiana in some ways are considered a rural hospital.
And if you could compare what Stephanie was talking about specifically happening at Union Hospital Clinton to what a lot of those other 35 critical access hospitals in the state are dealing with respect to the pandemic. I don't know. Do the pictures look similar?
Yeah, I think what Stephanie described is the typical experience, in that many hospitals have been impacted significantly by COVID, not everyone sort of right off the bat, if you will. We saw some outbreaks of coronavirus in southeastern Indiana early on, back in March and April. And we had some of the rural hospitals kind of in the Cincinnati area, but here in Indiana, were dramatically affected. Saw lots of very sick patients had challenges staffing the facilities because you had workforce nurses and physicians that had been exposed. And so they really had that first wave kind of early on. And they began a recovery after that. Then what we've seen in other places as we've had these kind of waves or wavelets of COVID outbreaks rolling through the state, it really feels like no area is going to be spared. But there's a bit of a cycle now of being dramatically impacted by COVID, whether you're in a rural area or an urban area, and then a period perhaps where it slows down a bit and hospitals are able to begin that financial recovery. And another recovery that's really critical right now because of the length of this pandemic is the recovery for staff. I would say one thing that I'm hearing around the state is that Stephanie talked about how important it is to take care of the workforce and what they've done there at Union and Union Clinton. And that really is critical because our frontline caregivers, the nurses and physicians and others, the environmental service workers who take care of cleaning the hospital, which is so critical right now, they've been under a lot of strain for a really long time. And that's something I hear around the state. And it's a challenge for rural hospitals because workforce, I know we heard early on in the program that that's a challenge for hospitals, that recruitment and retention. And so that's a big part of what folks are facing now, those workforce challenges.
If we could broaden things a little bit, I mean, can you talk about what you're seeing right now with the pandemic with respect not just to critical access hospitals, but all rural hospitals with whom you're affiliated?
Mm-hmm. We are, again, we're seeing these kind of rolling waves of COVID outbreaks where at times the hospitals are at fairly normal capacity and are able to kind of resume that journey towards some sense of, you know, the norm. I know we're all looking for that kind of new normal and what that looks like. But for hospitals, that means getting patients back to take care of those important screenings and preventative care that Stephanie talked about that are so important. But then in many communities around the state, COVID is just sort of lurking there. And we've seen some spikes where it has come back. And then as the beds start to fill up with patients with coronavirus, that can sort of create capacity issues and has a strain on the workforce. I know Stephanie talked about Fountain County and some of the counties in that area. I know that we're seeing some data to indicate that community spread there of COVID is ticking up. And we're seeing that in some counties in the northern part of the state and in southwestern Indiana right now in particular. I would say the kind of north central corridor and southwestern Indiana, probably the biggest right now in terms of COVID. But what it really seems like, Matt, is it's sort of rolling. I know there's a lot of talk about first wave, second wave. But I think what we see is that communities start to do a good job of controlling the spread. And then there's a relaxation. And there could be some community event or just generally, you know, family activities like graduation parties or barbecues, and then all of a sudden, we see the rates spike. And what we've got to do across the state, or in the hospitals, but really those frontline caregivers who are working around the clock now to take care of patients with COVID and patients without COVID, is do the things that we need to do. Wear masks. Practice good hand hygiene, use sanitizer, wash your hands, social distance, do all of those things. Because whether it's in urban areas, and now we're seeing it in rural areas, COVID is still very much with us.
We're talking with Brian Tabor, the president of the Indiana Hospital Association, about how the COVID-19 pandemic is affecting rural hospitals in Indiana. And we also have Stephanie Laws with us. She's vice president and administrator at Union Hospital Clinton. Stephanie, I have I know some people in Vermilion County, Clinton specifically. There's talk of I mean, there's talk statewide of a second wave, but things, according to them, look not great in Clinton. Are you seeing the same?
Yes, we are. And we really rely upon the data from the Indiana State Department of Health, who publishes a daily dashboard regarding not only the number of cases, but what the most important factor of that is the 7-day positivity rate in that identified community. So Vermilion County, as you mentioned, has seen that uptick. Park County has seen a pretty significant uptick within the last 7 days, putting them around 15% positivity rate. And then, as Brian indicated earlier in the show, Fountain County also having a pretty good spike. So we rely upon that data because as testing has expanded, not all patients tend to be tested here through our laboratory. And as a matter of fact, because rural counties have, you know, not so robust public health departments, you know, you take, for example, Park County has a half-time nurse and a sanitation director. We partnered with both Park and Vermilion counties to supply the manpower and the resources to have COVID testing clinics within these rural communities. You know, we know that our population already have disparities of lack of public transportation. They're elderly. They can't always move from community to community. And so we have created these testing sites along with our public health departments within each of these rural communities to better meet that need.
Is there a risk at hospitals like yours, perhaps even your hospital, Union Hospital Clinton, of not being able to handle a second wave, depending on how bad it is, I suppose?
Well, I think that this is something that, along with our emergency preparedness, we have long prepared for. None of us saw this unprecedented pandemic. And I think Brian summed it up very well. It's not first wave and second wave. It's rolling. Mm. Our preparation at this point is looking at 2 years to have screeners at the front tables of our entranceways, to have masks on universally in the healthcare environment. I think that we know from the science that, you know, for the distribution and the impact of a vaccine and or the herd immunity is going to take an unwavering amount of time for us to see that through. So operationally, we have really put measures in place to see ourselves through. In terms of overall census capacity, we also work with the state in terms of putting in our resource allocation every day in terms of utilized ventilators, types of patients in beds, so that we could potentially, as part of just one piece of a rural hospital in Western Indiana, work with the entire state. And the Indiana Hospital Association has been just front and center to help support all of us through that if we have to mobilize regional-based resources or state-based resources, we have those longer-range plans in place if we were ever to get to that type of a storm.
And so, Brian, can you show us what that might look like? I guess you being the president of the Indiana Hospital Association, got a couple minutes left, but I think that's enough time to unpack that.
Yeah, I think, I do want to answer that, what that looks like. But I think it's just important to keep in mind here that the challenges of COVID for rural hospitals are significant. But there is this underlying fragility in rural healthcare. And what I really worry about is certainly a second wave. And so I worry about what that looks like. I, without the help that Congress provided through the CARES Act, I really thought earlier this summer, I remember in May and even early June, thinking that we would have some hospitals that may not be able to keep their doors open through the 4th of July or Labor Day. But I think because of that significant federal action, that has helped stabilize many facilities in Indiana. And I think they're well prepared for COVID. And this is what hospitals do. They maintain a high state of readiness for their communities. But But there is a strain that we will see play out over the long haul. And as Stephanie said, this is not going to be just a question of a few more months. It'll be some time. I think we are going to start to see a vaccine and therapeutics that will help us treat it even better than today. So I don't want to be overly negative, but we just know that that strain will exist. And we've seen rural hospitals close across the country at a very alarming rate. 174 have closed since 2005, and 132 of those just since 2010. And around the country this year, I believe we're on a record pace. Fortunately, that has not happened in Indiana, and I don't see that happening this calendar year. But we did have a rural hospital close in Indiana last year before COVID. So I think there's this underlying fragility in rural healthcare for all of the things that your guests have talked about today. And what we really need to make sure is that our rural hospitals that are just such important economic anchors, the anchors of public health, really in many cases, the provider of public health in our rural areas, that they survive not just for the short run, but for the long haul.
We'll be back after a quick break. We're talking about how rural hospitals are doing during the pandemic and why some are concerned about the impact of a second wave. And if you have questions or comments for our guest today, we would love to hear from you. You can find us on Facebook or Twitter at All In Indiana, or leave us a voicemail. 866-476-3881 is the number to call. Or you can leave us a high quality voice message with our All In Vox Pop app, wherever you get apps. Just search All In Vox Pop. I'm Matt Pelser. We're back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. Back now to our discussion on rural hospitals in Indiana and the impact they're feeling from the COVID-19 pandemic. And if you're interested after the show, check out a recent feature on the issue from Side Effects reporter Carter Barrett. You can find it on sideeffectspublicmedia.org. As always, we would love your input on the conversation. We're on Facebook and Twitter at All In Indiana, or we would love to hear your voice in the conversation with a short voicemail. Leave your first name and where you're calling from at 866-476-3881, along with a short message for us. 866-476-3881, or leave us a high quality audio message with our All In Vox Pop app. Just search All In Vox Pop wherever you get apps. We have with us Brian Tabor, president of the Indiana Hospital Association, and Stephanie Laws, vice president and administrator at Union Hospital Clinton in Vermilion County. So, Stephanie, I want to go back to the spring, and I'm wondering what this was like for your hospital when the pandemic first started in March.
Yes, it was devastating. I mean, as a critical access hospital, and as Brian has indicated, rural hospitals, we operate on a thin margin. We're very volume dependent. And we did not get a COVID wave, if you will, there in the early spring. So we have to control expenses where they are, especially when we're cutting out those elective procedures and diagnostic studies. And so it financially was very devastating. And not to mention at that time, we saw an increase in some of our supply costs, specifically around personal protection equipment, an increase in supply chain challenges in acquiring equipment. And we also saw some issues with our pharmaceutical supply chain as well as costs. So, you know, our outputs remained the same in terms of the function at that time that we provided for our community, but our cost was increased. And, you know, it was a very unprecedented time for our staff and a lot of changes, if not on a daily basis, sometimes multiple times in a day. To keep it in front of.
Now, we've heard a lot about those narrowing margins with respect to increased costs. You mentioned PPE and pharmaceuticals. I mean, did those costs go up simply because you were using more, or was the cost of that equipment and those resources going up because the demand was getting so high? And how has it weathered since then, I guess?
I believe it was the latter. I think it was a result of supply chain issues.
So not only were you buying more, but it was more expensive to buy them.
Yeah, if not impossible to get. And so we had to develop different strategies to have longer term solutions. And what I mean by that is the N95 respirator masks were very hard to come by in those early days. And so that prompted us to buy more sustainable equipment, which would be the PAPRs, if you will, just so that we would have more sustainable use from them versus a mask that we could technically disinfect and use several times in between patient care. But it also comes at a cost, you know, disinfection of your masks or how we're going to contend with, you know, the multiple gowns and the time that it took to rule out or rule in COVID for a patient in the early days when testing wasn't as available as what it is today.
Hospitals are full of knowledgeable people, obviously. So you've got enough people there who know what's going on and who know to listen to the science. But all the help you can get is appreciated, of course. So what has communication been like in respect to guidelines, protocols, things like that? Have they been as clear as they need to be?
Well, the communication channel that Union Health has primarily utilized is that of the voice of the Indiana Hospital Association. Brian and his staff have been key in helping us to unpack and digest the multitude of informational pieces that have come out both at the federal and the state level.
Brian, how much goalying are you doing in that regard, or rather is the Indiana Hospital Association doing, is meaning getting that correct information out to the people who need to hear it as quickly as possible, making corrections as well along the way?
Yeah, you know, quite a bit, I would say. And I appreciate the kind words from Stephanie. You know, our team here has been working hard. We always work hard, but it's just been very proud of the team and their effort, their tireless effort since COVID first descended on Indiana to just work for our members just every day, pushing out the information, taking in the feedback from the members, trying to understand what they're experiencing on the ground and how we can assist. We have a strong partnership with the state of Indiana. I have to say that Governor Holcomb's team there and Dr. Chris Box, our state health commissioner, I really feel that a lot of our team they've been in the foxhole, I think, with Dr. Box's team working on the reporting requirements for hospitals. Hospitals have to send data daily now to the federal government through an online portal to track the number of COVID patients, testing, the amount of personal protective equipment that's on hand. And the guidance on that has changed. And, you know, I say that not as a criticism of the federal government. They are building some systems that didn't exist before. So when you are in an unprecedented event like this, there are unprecedented regulations and policies that come forth. So we work with our federal partners to try to, you know, take things as they come, see what those regulations are. We share them with the membership so that they can implement those. And then working with the congressional delegation in other areas where we've had to seek some changes in legislation and regulations. I really want to say our congressional delegation here in Indiana has been strong partners as well. But there is always a lot of new regulation and information that comes from the federal government in a normal time. And so during the pandemic, it's been that by some multiple, I don't know exactly what, but it's significant. And that's a lot. That's a lot for rural hospitals in particular, because you have smaller teams. Folks like Stephanie that are administrators of a hospital like Union Clinton, they have to wear a lot of hats. And I'm probably sending her, as well as my other members, a lot of emails every day. You need to report this. You need to change the protocol for that. You need to apply for this critical funding. And in a larger organization, you can spread that across other people. In rural hospitals, that's a bigger challenge. So that's one more thing I think that one more difficulty that smaller facilities face is without that scale, when you have all of these policy changes, it's just tough to stay on top of it.
Stephanie Laws, how much of an issue has funding been for Union Hospital Clinton?
Well, as Brian indicated, you know, it has been such a huge relief to get those CARES Act dollars into our state, not only for our critical access hospital, but the 35 other critical access hospitals and acute care facilities across the state. We again, have a very thin operating margin that is dependent upon volume, dependent upon procedures, and without having some of those subsidies that come in and some of the waivers that we've been afforded from the state, it would be a difficult, at best, challenge for us.
What about workforce? Have you had issues with your workforce there?
Yes. It is already been identified for the last couple of years that we've had a registered nurse shortage, and that is no different at this point. We have had all kinds of licensed healthcare providers that are continuing to be in demand. And as Brian indicated, you know, we staff based on our volume and usual census, and when things bottomed out for us, at least in the spring, we cross-trained employees maybe to areas that they had not been working before to accommodate their hours and to keep their benefits and such like that. So we got very creative with those strategies. But, you know, honestly, when our census goes up, we still have the same staff, right? So we have to be very resilient. We continue to see RN nursing shortages. We continue to see physician recruitment and retention. We have our own inpatient hospitalist program, and a couple of our physicians are also primary care physicians. And so that has been somewhat of a challenge to work across the aisle and make sure all needs are met during this pandemic. And, you know, honestly, we have created positions. We have created positions for COVID screeners at our entrances. We have hired swabbers for our curbside here at the hospital, and then also at the public health department sites, which are seasonal. And so to recruit folks for those roles has been a challenge, not easy to fill, because it does require a certain skill set. And people also willing to screen for COVID.
Brian Tabor, let's pull out and look at the statewide view of this. And do the workforce challenges at other rural hospitals reflect what Stephanie's going through?
Yes, I think that workforce challenges are really at the top for rural hospitals, generally speaking, before COVID.
Before, so, during, and after. So it'll continue to be an issue.
And after, yeah. So much like that financial fragility, I think what you have with workforce challenges is these things are magnified as you get into a rural community. So generally speaking, in the state of Indiana, and really nationally, you have a shortage of nurses. We know we need more nurses to take care of our aging population. We know that we have a primary care physician shortage, fewer physicians out there nationally. And so Indiana has those challenges. And then you get into your rural communities where you have just generally look at the trends in our country. People tend to want to relocate to urban areas or suburban areas. And so you have some challenges unless you have an individual who's maybe from a rural area or they were trained, got their healthcare education in a rural setting, it can be harder to recruit them back to a community. So rural hospitals have that, face great difficulties on a regular basis. And then when you layer on top of that, the strain, additional requirements and responsibilities now needed during COVID that Stephanie talked about, that makes it even more difficult. So Now, we're, you know, fortunate in Indiana to have some great partners like the Bowen Institute for Health Policy here in Indianapolis that helps look more strategically at the healthcare workforce in Indiana, and other partners like the state of Indiana, which has a very robust healthcare workforce initiative. So I think we are starting to address some of those. But right now during COVID, it's a difficult time because many healthcare professionals, there are some who are just taking some time off. So that can be difficult to staff up a facility. So I think right now I feel very good about hospitals across the state and their ability to take care of all patients safely. As the recovery has gotten underway, I think you know, we've been able to staff up, get the personal protective equipment, and we're doing okay right now. But that second wave and that additional strain on the workforce would be a real challenge.
Brian, let's look at the after, or at least the near after. What will the process be like when a vaccine is released, when distribution starts for rural hospitals? What kind of challenges will there be there?
Yeah, you know, Stephanie touched on something before that I think is often overlooked of the role of a rural hospital. It's often noted that they are the largest employers in that county, maybe in a multi-county region. But Indiana, and this is a long-standing issue, it goes back decades. Indiana has always been a state that has had inadequate funding of public health. And so in these smaller counties with a small tax base and very lean local government, the funding for public health just is not there. So it is often, it's frequently provided by the hospitals. So that extends to some of the things that I know Phil Ellis and Kara Veal talked about earlier, education and efforts to reduce tobacco use, reduce obesity. Stephanie talked about testing. Right now with COVID, hospitals in many communities are partnering with the state, but leading efforts to increase community-based testing for COVID. And I see a similar role for hospitals in terms of vaccination. You're going to see rural hospitals and other hospitals as the hub of that vaccine distribution and education. I think our members are trusted partners of the community. And one of the things that we're going to have to work with Hoosiers on is understanding that vaccines are safe and that our path back to economic recovery is going to require continued vigilance about COVID. Just because a vaccine appears initially doesn't mean we can stop everything we've been doing. We're going to have to continue the mask wearing and social distancing for some time. But that vaccination strategy, it will change depending on which vaccines come first. They're all very different, and they'll have different targets in terms of population, different ways that they're distributed. But hospitals are going to play a really important role in smaller communities around the state to be that hub of distribution.
In about 15 seconds, would you say that that this pandemic could mean more adequate funding for public health once it's all over?
Well, I hope so. I do think it has shown a light on the importance of public health, that the education, the testing, the workforce, the community interventions, those are all really important in a pandemic, but they're really important on a regular basis. We need them to help combat flu and combat our rates of chronic disease in the state. So it's been a challenge, but I'm hopeful that there could be some additional funding down the road.
Brian Tabor is president of the Indiana Hospital Association. Brian, thanks for your time today.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Stephanie Laws is vice president and administrator at Union Hospital Clinton. Stephanie, great insight.
Thank you. Thank you for having me as well.
Our producers are Drew Dodlin and Micah Yason. Scott Cameron's our managing editor. I'm Matt Pelser. Thanks for listening. This is All In.